Okay, so basically, the paper I wrote for this talk is a kind of the result of a preliminary analysis of the fieldwork that I'm doing for my PhD. And I've titled it Feminist Tales of the Italian Resistance, Utopian Visions and Gender Ideologies in Municipal Preschools in Reggio Emilia, 1963 to the present. And the pictures are some of the, so the black and white pictures are actually from actual pictures from the 1940s of the partisans, and then so these are historical documents, and then from the library in Italy where I work from, and then other the colored pictures are instead pictures taken during a parade that was. Occurring just like this 25th of April, which is the day of the liberation of Italy from the Allies, from the Axis, and it was basically a reenactment of the day of the liberation, and so there's this contrast, So many times, this is a quote. Many times during the winter nights. Instead of telling us tales, both my mom and my dad would tell us the episodes of the episode of the cooperative, and they would recall when the fascists from the campanile in the town of Sant'Ilario would try to shoot toward the rooftops of the cooperative because some anti-fascists were hiding there, and when they entered in our home, they looked everywhere around and they destroyed everything, humiliating my mother, who was still a young woman. This talk examines what Lidia Greci, in this passage just read, refers to as the tales of the Italian resistance, to address the question, has the Italian resistance left any legacy to the women after the Second World War? The Italian resistance, 1943 to 1945, consisted... You know what the Italian is. So it consisted of groups of varying political positions who temporarily united around anti-fascist and anti-Nazist values for the liberation of Italy from the regime. The resistance was both an art movement of groups known as the partisans and a civil resistance, which was a non-violent movement that provided support for the fighting partisans. Women played an important role both in the armed and in the civil resistance, moving away from the home into the public realm. There is a debate, however, among historians around whether the resistance left any legacy to the women after the war. Some have argued that they left no legacy, that it has left no legacy, and this is because after the war, most women went back to the domestic life or to welfare work that was viewed simply as a traditionally feminine role. This talk challenges the thesis that the resistance left no legacy to women after the war by way of examining women teachers' collective imaginaries around the resistance in these particular schools in Reggio Emilia in Italy and its influence on teachers' gender experiences. Reggio Emilia is a small town of about 170,000 inhabitants, situated in the Italian region of Emilia-Romagna, where the R is, an area that played a central role in the Italian resistance. Emilia-Romagna indeed counted about 70,000 partisans, being one of the regions with the largest groups of partisans during the war, alongside with all those near the regions, nearby regions such as Piemonte, Liguria, and Tuscany, which is generally called the Red Belt of Italy because it's like the communist, really, area of Italy. After the war, Reggio Emilia saw the development of a strong movement of women's emancipation led by the UDI, which is the Union of Italian Women, a group that was born out of women's partisan movements and which in Reggio Emilia counted a large number of members nationwide. With the substantial contribution of the UDI in Reggio Emilia, numerous preschools were founded after the war. Then, in 1963, these preschools were municipalized and new ones created. Today, these schools are renowned internationally for their high-quality education. And the model has been exported, like, on an international level. Because of their history, which is fundamentally and essentially related to the Italian resistance, these schools offer for an ideal case study to examine the role of women in welfare work after the war. This research endorses an interdisciplinary framework combining the works of Ricord with that of Peter Moss and Joan Dillabaugh. It involves the analysis of classroom documentation as well as interviews with women who contributed to the foundation and the development of the municipal schools in Reggio Emilia from 1963 to the present. So I begin by considering the utopian views at the basis of the schools and their relationship with the memories of the Italian resistance, and then I analyze the way that these utopian views of society might have contributed to challenge gender ideologies among teachers in the schools under consideration. Everyday utopias. According to Ricord, ideology and utopia are two imaginative practices that shape the experience and motivate the actions of individuals as well as collective entities, group, classes, and nations. Ricord argues that ideology and utopia are exact counterparts. Ideology, on the one hand, is a system that legitimizes the authority of a group by way of concealing how power works to reinforce authority through simplified, schematized, and stereotyped descriptions. Utopia, on the other hand, is the imaginary project of another society, another reality. Utopia, in other words, is the process by which we radically rethink another society, where this other way can mean things as diametrically opposed as a more rational or more ethical authority, or the complete absence of power. This was a quote. Following Ricord's definition of utopia, the educational practices in the municipal schools in Reggio Emilia could be seen as taking up a utopian view of society, originally constructed against the authoritarian values associated with the fascist regime. This emerges from some of the documents from the early 1970s, which state, "The institution of the preschool is sure that the values that produced it are the same values that motivated participation in the lives of the city and in the schools, as an anti-fascist choice. Moreover, only through the desire of overcoming the existing separation between the political reality and the schools, it is possible to realize a school that can educate toward freedom, solidarity, sociality, and democracy." In another document states, "The committee wants to underline the strong and open bond that has to exist between the education of new generation and the democratic society born out of the resistance." But the connection between the anti-authoritarian view of society in the schools and the resistance emerges also from the interviews with the women, both the women who played a role in the foundation of the schools and the women who still work in the schools today. Anti-fascist has been in my family and in the social context. Narratives were very important. The other interviewees might have also told you that in our lens, fascism has been really repressive. It was really characterized by episodes of violence, like the fires seen in the cooperatives and the houses. There were also the killings in the popular housing on the 1st of May, because the fascists knew that we would celebrate it, and so they would come shooting at people. If they knew that someone was an anti-fascist, that would force them to drink the castor oil, or they would beat him up. There were also narratives of stories that happened very close to us when we were displaced. For example, I remember an episode from when I was little, because I'm born in 1941 and the war ended in 1945. I was very little. We were in the town of Sfondondo of Correggio. It's a nice name. It's a really small town. In this little town, an important episode of the resistance of Reggio took place. That is, Vittorio Saltini, who was one of the leaders of the resistance in Reggio, went to visit his family that lived in the area. The fascists probably were told by someone that he was there, and they killed him. But the sister, who learned what was happening and was also part of the resistance, threw herself on the body of the brother to defend him, and the fascist also killed her on the body of the brother. This episode really stayed with me, really as a symbol of injustice, violence, and inhumanity. It really was the social context that generated a great swell of opposition to the regime that was oppressive, humiliating of people, and violent. I grew up in this social context of simple but utopian ideals for a society of freedom and equality. So the women were strong because of this experience in the foundation and the development of the preschools in Reggio Emilia that carried the signature of women and their experiences of the war and their desire to have schools in a certain way, and different from the ones that we had. that is, where children were merely a number and they counted nothing, and we were not allowed to do anything. So we lived during the horrors and the fear of the bombs and of the people, which actually was an English plane, but in the narrative of this woman was associated with, you know, the war in general and the fascists. That we learned this only after the war. It was used to scare people, and it was important that the children paid attention to it. It arrived during the night. I can still hear it. I don't know what it actually threw down. And so there was a lot of anti-fascist sentiment. Poor people, but the fascists were there. They were crazy. So our context was anti-fascist. In this climate, after the war, there was a lot of desire to change things and to build a new society. We wanted women to have the right to work and the assurance that the children would go to school in proper schools and not just in structures where they were just parked for the period of time where the mothers were at work. The stories of the Italian resistance extend also to include women. I believe that there is an important relationship with the resistance that the school have. First and foremost, we are in Reggio Emilia. This educational experience has not happened in other regions in Italy. Then for us, women have been partisans. They fought in the resistance, both as soldiers and in the civil resistance. I remember that my mom, I was born after the end of the war, but my mother with my sister, who was very little at the time, she was a staffetta, which basically were these women who were carrying messages between one town and the other to the partisans. So, for example, she says she would put my sister on the backpack in the front of her bike where there were messages that she would take to the partisans. And then they would tell me that, like, when it was not too scary, they would put it in the backpack. But when it was really scary, they would hide it in their socks. I don't know what. Do you see? What I mean is that the women wanted to be there, and they were there, and they had the space to be there. In this culture, we were the first ones in Italy to start to hire men in preschools. In my school, there was a man. It's not like there were many men, but in Italy, in general, it was still illegal to hire men in preschool. So this was a sign of a desire for gender equality in these schools. This other woman says, the resistance and some feminine figures were known. This woman, she shows these pictures to me, was a fighting partisan. These women were for us model and heroes. This is Laila. This is her fighting name. She was seen as a... She was seeing a guy at the time, but then she had to go in the mountains to escape from the fascists because it had become dangerous to her. At that point, her boyfriend told her not to go, saying he wanted to marry a woman that stayed in the home, so she broke up with him and went up in the mountains with the partisans anyways. These women were for us models of life and courage, women who really chose to do things that went against women's traditional social status at the time. Then there were the young boys who did not want to fight, and the women hid them in the house, gave them food and clothes, and helped them to find their way to the mountain. It was a mass phenomenon, not only few women, only the bravest ones. It was a movement that started with an ethical and political motivation. But it was really dangerous for them. This was the beginning of the awareness, as it was also proven by the creation of the groups of defense of women during the war, where there was, which was a partisan group of women, where there were also talk about the equality between men and women. There was a vision about what it meant to have a democracy and what was the place of women in this democracy. This is the highest level, the mass participation. It's really the element of humanity and solidarity. And you can find this also as a fundamental value in the schools. So, as it emerges in these interviews, women have seen the preschools in Reggio Emilia as spaces that had an agenda for political change, that is, for the construction of a more ethical, anti-authoritarian, more egalitarian, democratic society, fundamentally and essentially based on the values of the resistance, a vision that Ricoh would define as utopian. And this utopia also extends to concerns around gender equality. A former teacher and the current pedagogy director says, talking about the social vision in the municipal schools in Reggio Emilia, I saw this from the very beginning, about the values, saw a utopia very strong, the idea of a new society that is a culture of freedom, of anti-authoritarianism, anti-hierarchical, society, and this extends also to gender. For me, the concern about gender was a movement that was motivated by this need for freedom, for a new society, anti-authoritarian. But the manifestation of this value in the schools, expresses a utopia in the now, in the everyday life. This is because we do not give a lesson to the children about how to be citizens in the future, but every day we live in a democratic situation where we all attempt to listen to each other, an everyday utopia. So, resisting traditional gender ideology, the image of the teacher in the municipal schools in Reggio Emilia. But how, if in any way, has this everyday utopia contributed to reproduce or resist gender ideologies in the municipal schools in Reggio Emilia? It has been found that in the everyday utopia of the municipal preschools in Reggio Emilia, the role of the teacher differs from the gendered role of the teacher in the traditional discourse around early childhood education. And this is linked to this political project that the teacher are talking about. Sociologists and educational theorists, indeed. Too much thinking about this. Sociologists and educational theorists, indeed, have shown that in schools, particularly in the context of early childhood education, the teacher, who is usually a woman, is described in gender terms as a care worker, a substitute family member, be it a mother, a housewife, or a daughter to elderly parents. Just like a mother, the teacher is expected to nurture, love, and care for the children, even at the risk of her own experiences, truths, and desires. But as Moss argues, this traditionally gendered image of the teacher assumes that very little education is, quote, needed to undertake the work which is understood as requiring qualities and competencies that are either innate to women, the maternal instinct, or else are acquired through women practices of domestic labor, housework skills. End quote. Further, as Dilabo argues, this role of the teacher as a care worker has been based on a distinction between the private sphere of the home and the public political sphere, end quote, the association of particular gender relations with each spheres. This has meant that women have been socially constructed as non-citizens because of their supposed natural affiliation with the private sphere. End quote. So as Moss and Dilabo both suggest, the school, particularly in the realm of early childhood education, has typically functioned as an extension of the private realm of the home, where teachers, usually women, have been constructed in gendered ways as surrogate mothers, naturally suited to the care of children, rather than as political subjects. In sharp contrast, however, with this traditional image of the teacher as a care worker in early childhood education, is the role of the teacher in Reggio Emilia. This is described well by one of the teachers, who says, "I never felt like the mother of the children, but as an educating figure. I have a role of significant relationship with the children, the parents, and together with the families and the parents, we are part of a particular project that for me has no comparison in other realities, and I began to understand this from very early on." Also, the other teacher think of it this way. "I was able to notice the difference between a teacher in a traditional preschool that has this role of the second mother because she's not supported by the other teachers and by the theoretical education that we receive. My theoretical and professional formation has helped me to overcome these traditional and conventional ways. So all the professional development and the exchange with my colleagues has helped me to move away from this conception of the teacher as a second mother and to become a professional and educating figure. It's the awareness of being part of a collective and public project." So from this interview, it emerges that in these schools, women teachers move away from a traditionally gendered role of a teacher as a surrogate mother. This is because the teacher is seen as part of a political project, the everyday utopia. And this utopia, rather than just as a care worker, and in this utopia, rather than just as a care worker, the teacher, as one of the interviews has put it, is seen as an active citizen worker. Finally, in contrast with the image of the teacher as a care worker, which, as Dilabo has also shown, often impedes women's ability to function as political agents in their own right, women teachers in Reggio Emilia claim to have been empowered as women because of their role as citizens' workers. For example, a teacher states, We worked a great deal. There was a lot of participation in the life of the city. We went to all these meetings. My husband used to tell me, but to have a preschool, you need to go to all these meetings. The other day, I was talking to some of my colleagues, and we recalled that it was a job that really excited us. We felt part of a collective project. It was not a burden for us. But it was also work that played a role in the construction of our own identity. To be able to go out at night with a bike or walking, things that women would not do back then in Reggio. So as it emerges from this interview, what's next? Okay. As it emerges from this interview, the role of the teacher in the school in Reggio Emilia as an active political agent has motivated women teachers to challenge traditional gender ideologies. For example, as it has this interview has illustrated, it has encouraged women to challenge a gender division of labor between the private and the private realm by way of motivating women to actively participate in the life of the city. So, from the analysis of the interviews and the classroom documentation, it has emerged that among women teachers in the municipal schools in Reggio Emilia, there is a utopian view of society, which describes the schools as spaces for the construction of the anti-authoritarian view of society, fundamentally based on the anti-fascist value of the Italian resistance, what Ricoeur would define a utopia. Furthermore, as Ricoeur would also expect, this utopia has contributed to challenge traditional gender ideologies in the schools. And this is because it has constructed the teacher as a political agent rather than merely as a second mother. This has empowered women teachers and encouraged them to resist traditional gender ideologies, such as the private-public traditionally gender distinction in their everyday lives. Therefore, we can claim that the resistance can be seen as having left a legacy to the women after the war by way of motivating representation of education and teaching that have opposed traditional gendered ideologies.